Hi, Tom Athanasio. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Doing good. Talking to you. Tom Athanasio founded the organization EcoEquity, now affiliated with the Earth Island Institute. EcoEquity's mission is to demonstrate that success at reducing climate change to manageable levels, that is, saving the planet, will require international cooperation, in particular that the industrialized countries of the West, they've emitted the bulk of greenhouse gases for the last 50 years and created the climate crisis. They have an ethical obligation to send funds and a practical obligation to send funds and transfer technologies to enable poor and developed countries who have contributed near no greenhouse gas emissions, but they're now deeply suffering from climate change. They need resources, especially to adapt their food and water systems, but the rich countries have resisted. That's despite setting up a special fund for that purpose. Rich countries have not contributed to the fund. It's a bit of greenwashing by them. A lot of it goes on. He's just home from the UNFCCC, that is United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, their 28th annual conference that mostly avoided the rich countries' obligation to the poor nation. But something unexpected and noteworthy did happen at the 28th. That's one topic we'll be discussed today. Is that action meaningful? Is it meaningful or just more greenwashing? And we'll also be discussing whether the UNFCCC can resist corporate pressure to adopt the corporate plan for dealing with climate change and give equal time and support for the emerging left plan known as energy democracy. First, Tom Athanasio, tell us about the UNFCCC's and the conference's history and purpose. There are meager accomplishments compared to the necessity. And like, who attends the conferences, who votes, who sets the agenda?
Well, I mean, the UNFCCC was spun up in the early 1990s after the Earth Summit, and it was charged with negotiating a global climate treaty that would stabilize the climate system. And it's a process that involves the parties, that is to say, the countries. And it's limited by the fact that it has no way of making decisions except by consensus. Bill, I don't know how long you've been on the left, but maybe you've been involved in some projects that used consensus decision-making, which can work well in some cases, but imagine trying to do something as complicated as completely reworking the political and economic infrastructure of a global civilization like ours by consensus. And you might then easily imagine why it's so difficult for the UN negotiations to make progress. Nevertheless, and I'm making a long story short here, there was language adopted at COP28 that just occurred in the United Arab Emirates that is arguably very significant. And that's language agreeing to transition away from fossil fuels. Now, there's no timeline on it. And the term transition away is not as concrete as we might like. But the movement organizations that met at the end of the COP and decided how to frame this outcome, by and large, agreed that the win was to agree that it was a step forward rather than denouncing it. Because as Bill McKibben put it very well, it gives us a new tool to use against the fossil fuel cartel. It doesn't in itself guarantee anything. But again, how could the UNFCCC guarantee anything when it can't even make decisions by supermajority and has no enforcement powers? So that's basically what happened. There's obviously a million more things to say about it.
It seems to me that bringing 208 countries together and having consensus is quite impossible. But in fact, it may well become possible when climate warming produces its absolutely, it seems to me, scientists say, inevitable enormous storms and floods and enormous damage to infrastructure, great deaths, and migrations of people who are living in places that are uninhabitable. At that point, it seems to me it's possible to get the countries of the world to agree, and we're not talking about getting all 208 to agree. All of them can be sort of pay. The smaller ones, it's a very large, powerful states that wield a hammer over the others now to just extract profits from them. In a crisis, it seems to me, it's possible that you could get a consensus. Sometimes there'd be a lot of arm twisting and threats by one country against a possible country that would not agree. But it seems to me in the crisis, with vast numbers of people dying and everybody affected, we could be lucky if that happens and it's not too late. So it seems to me the UNFCCC is important in fact sifting out the possible solutions. So Tom, you introduced the most noteworthy and possibly fruitful provision in this year's COP20. There were 28 of them in this year's conference 28. You introduced the transitioning out as a tool for us to hammer and persuade the powers that be that it had to be done and quickly. And we'll be, I think, supported by what's happening on the ground, namely that something has to be done and more people will agree. I'm dubious about whether that transition language resembles a whole lot of stuff that the corporations have been saying. I mean, every company, even the fossil fuel industry itself, on their websites and in their propaganda and their advertising, they all, even the Aramco, the third largest oil industry, Shell, Chevron, all of them on their website promise that they're, in fact, doing research in alternative fuels and carbon sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration, anything but, in fact, not using a lot of oil. They want to keep doing oil, and they are now promoting all of these technological systems, like carbon capture and allegedly safe nukes. They're promoting all of that stuff so that they can just keep selling oil. And the companies, too, they want to just keep selling goods. And the auto companies will electrify, but they want to sell a lot of SUVs, which they're doing now, the worst kind of personal transportation system. I mean, technology, the SUV. And I think that this seems to me could be just another one of their greenwashing. They've been doing greenwashing for a long time. Every company has supposedly green products and recognizes the need for dealing with climate change and that they're the good guys. Buy our goods. It's an advertising slogan without really any real effort to change things.
The corporates are so powerful and they're always going to pretend that they're part of the solution. They're greenwashing and the false solutions and the dangerous distractions. They're part of the political landscape. There's no question about that. And if we're taken in by them, we're in trouble. But that doesn't necessarily give us a rubric by which we can make strategic decisions. I mean, there has to be a way forward. We're not doomed. The outcome of strategic and tactical decisions that we make, you know, will make a huge difference. And the question is, you know, what we need to do. And we obviously need to regulate capital at a global level. And that involves the regulation of the corporations, but it also involves the regulation of state-based activities. You know, some of the largest oil companies in the world are not private corporations. They're actually state owned companies, as in the Gulf region and as in China with oil companies. Capital needs to be brought under control, and it has to, that has to be done even though there's going to be greenwashing going on. The question is, how do you do it? And what's, there's no question that the situation is desperate, but that certainly opens some doors as well as closing other doors, right? I mean, the very desperation of the situation and the need to act at a global scale and on an accelerated timeline, which is widely understood around the world, certainly opens some doors. It makes things possible that would not otherwise have been possible. So yeah, the greenwashing is real. It's a real problem, but the left contribution to the debate can't simply be to point to the greenwashing. The left also needs to make a contribution in the form of, this is what we need to do. This is our vision of transformation. And this is a strategy that we think should be pursued.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely on fighting back and having a possibility of even being heard, particularly as the climate catastrophes keep multiplying and more damaging. People will wake up and they want to be, and they demand action. There's going to be, it seems to me, a World War II kind of awakening when isolationist U.S. realized that the Japanese and the fascists really was threatening ultimately the United States if they were able to conquer the rest of the world, which was an open question at that time. And I agree we have to have our own plan. I believe that energy democracy is going to emerge as the left competitor to the corporate plan. What's your sense?
And what does energy democracy mean?
Well, I have the sense that it's using currently available technologies, solar and wind, that are getting more efficient and cheaper every day, using those technologies as they develop, and siting them locally where they can be locally controlled and where the public electricity provider can build a culture of energy conservation and use of use reduction and energy conservation and use reduction. And it seems to me we're never going to catch up to the growing, quote, needs of the American people if, in fact, they retain if they're part of a culture of conspicuous consumption and consumption and consumption. But the possibility of local energy without having the expense of building new grids across the United States.
Totally, mostly agree with you. This is absolutely a build out that we want to do. We want to build out renewables on a massive scale and not just in the United States. I mean,
no.
The decision that was made at the COP was to triple the rate of global renewables deployment. And in order to do that, it's necessary to make significant changes in the international financial system. But yeah, absolutely. This is one of the key things we have to do to pave a path forward. I would disagree with you about the need for a new grid build out. I absolutely believe that we need a new grid. And I don't think that we can build a renewable economy for a civilization of the scale of the current civilization without massively re-architecting the grid. Because of cities, we need cities, and cities have demands. They make demands. The one of the problems with the climate debate on the left is that people tend to rat hole into these small technical questions. The questions that we should be focusing on are political economic questions, and in particular, global political economic questions. Even the renewables build out, the question of how it could happen in a very wealthy country like the United States is very different from what it will take to build out renewables, say, in Africa, which is a place that was a tremendous need for a concentrated, visionary strategy to leapfrog the entire continent to renewable systems rather than building out fossil energy systems. I mean, these are the kind of questions that are at the center of the international debate. You know, it goes without saying that the rich countries of the world, the former imperial centers, have the technological and industrial capacity and financial capacity to rework domestic infrastructure. The question is, how are we going to redo this reworking at the international level? And in particular, how are we going to do it during a time of tremendous crisis? And I mean, those are the kinds of questions that take center stage at the COP, you know. And to close the discussion, I would just make a plea to your listeners to think globally. The climate crisis is a planetary crisis. It really is. And it's coming to us at a time when the international political situation is extremely unstable and extremely dangerous. And the question is whether or not the climate mobilization can become an occasion for large-scale international cooperation rather than degenerating into another occasion for conflict and vituperation. And I do think it's possible. I do think that we can cooperate, and we need to think about that. We need to think about what it would mean to face up to the global crisis and what it means in particular for the rich parts of the world where most of the rich people live, and how the wealth of the rich is going to be redirected towards climate mobilization. I really think we need to think about those kinds of big questions.
Yeah, I think we obviously have to act internationally. There's nuclear powers all over the world that could blackmail us or set one off, which would end everything. I mean, there's so many reasons that, and there's ethical reasons, there's practical reasons that we have to be internationalists. But we also have to, in the United States, we have to build out models of successful model cities that, in fact, are zero carbon and real zero carbon, not the accountant's zero carbon. And if we do that, and when the crunch comes, when people wake up to the huge threat, I think that we have a chance of, in fact, building that energy democracy system and defeating the corporate plan of fancy technology, doing everything the same way except having technology. Anyway.
Bill, I completely agree. Absolutely agree.
Yeah. Tom Athanasio, thanks for talking to us today.